Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books, which is an indie press that publishes socially engaged or socially conscious literature. We are currently going through submissions for stuff for next year, so we don't really have much news on that front, but I'm sure we will publish something that's great that you'll want to read. With me, as always, are the other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. And today we are going to talk about Hans's pick, a novel by Gustav Meyrink called The Golem. I really wouldn't know how to describe this, and I don't really know what I feel about it or what I even think it's about, so I'm not going to try. So I'm just going to hand it over to you, Hans, and you can kind of provide us the context or the shape of the discussion that you want.
So that's probably a bad sign that you don't know what to say about it or how to feel about it or what it's about, because I've read it now 3 times, and as I said on the last episode, I'm very fond of it, actually. I do feel, I think, positively toward it, even though there are things that I think are reasonable critiques one could make of it as a whole. But I don't have any idea what it's really about. I think now I know what happens in it, but I don't know really what it's all, like thematically, what it's trying to get at, if anything, or, you know, what...
Well, at least tell us what happens in it, because
I think we can all get on the same... That's a good idea, yeah.
What did you say, Chris?
Just as a way to kind of...
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But in terms of the shape of the conversation, that really is the shape of the conversation, right? It's like, can you guys help me figure this weird, enigmatic little novel out? So a little bit of background, I guess, before I do the plot synopsis. This was published in, I believe, 1914, originally in German. We read the translation by Mike Mitchell from the, I think, early 90s. And Gustav Meyrink was an odd character. He was very, in his own life, he was very interested in magic and spiritualism and a lot of different esoteric practices, and was almost sort of like had a little bit of the relationship of like a Harry Houdini to contemporary spiritualism, where he was very interested in it, but it often struck him as... In practice, a lot of what was happening around spiritual movements at the time often struck him as false or charlatanism. But the anecdote that he tells is that he was in his mid-20s and he was about to kill himself. And he had literally like raised the gun to his head. And while he was preparing to pull the trigger, somebody slipped a pamphlet about spiritualism under the door. And he thought, oh, well, I'll see what this is before I do the final act. And from then became very interested in all kinds of magic and different esoteric practices. And in fact, I mean, the most of the spiritual context for this book is rooted in the Kabbalah and in Jewish mysticism, but it begins with a quote from the Buddha, and it has kind of these moments of some of the key kind of phrases are taken from Hindu and Buddhist writing, right? And we'll come back to those in a bit. But there's already, I mean, for something written, especially in the early 1900s, there's already this kind of pan-spiritualist quality to it, where it's drawing on some different traditions that you wouldn't expect people in 1914 to necessarily be aware of. And it took him, I think, about 7 years to write this, which one of the things, to jump ahead a little bit, one of the things that is confusing about it is it has kind of a scattershot episodic quality, I think. And some of that is understood by scholarship now to just have to do with being written in fits and starts over a period of 7 years and published serially over a very long period of time. So for being a relatively short book, it had a long and tortured creation. And I think maybe you can see some hints of that structurally. And it may be one thing that can be hard to tell with this novel is the distinctions between deliberate artistic effects and accidents of the process of creation, again, in terms of the episodic, fractured nature of it. So that's sort of the background for the author and the period that it came out in. It's, you mentioned that you weren't sure how to describe it. It's sometimes, when I bought it, some of the things that I had read about it kind of suggested it was sort of an early horror novel, almost in the same tradition as maybe Dracula or going earlier back, Frankenstein. I don't think that's true at all. It'll sometimes be lumped in with German Expressionism, you know, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari kind of stuff. I don't know enough about Expressionism to critique that idea in depth, but I think that it's maybe a flawed one. It was adapted into a silent film that's, I think, considered an early expressionist work. But it stands on its own in terms of any clear relationship to any other literary or artistic movement.
Just to add, to my mind, it struck me a little bit somewhat like Kafka.
Sure.
But, you know. That was just a thought. Go on.
Yeah, there are definitely some Kafka-esque elements. I think it's not nearly as bleak as Kafka, and it has this odd mixture. Emotionally, it has this odd mixture of, in some places, very intensely felt emotional warmth, and then in other places, a kind of, not just cynicism, but almost kind of ferocity of feeling, right? It's a very almost irrationally angry novel in some places, but then it also has this kind of genuine warmth, especially at the end, that sits very oddly next to that, right? And those extremes of emotion, I think, are not totally Kafka-esque, right? If you think about a lot of what kind of characterizes Kafka is the coldness of the narrative, the coldness of the narrative voice in relationship to what's being experienced. And this is kind of the opposite of that, even though the scenarios in question are sometimes, yes, very Kafkaesque. So kind of the background of the plot of the novel then, and you guys can jump in if I'm overlooking anything or if there's something that you want to highlight or, you know, anything that you think will help flesh this out. But let me see if I can put all this together from memory now. So the narrator, the ostensible narrator of the novel, really only appears as himself at the beginning and briefly at the end, right? And the narrator of the novel is... He puts on a hat that belongs to somebody named Athanasius Pernath, which is a fantastic name. He accidentally takes Athanasius Pernath's hat. I've never actually said that name aloud before, so it's going to take a few times to get comfortable with it, I think. But he takes his hat, he puts it on by mistake, and then I think that night sort of falls into a dream. And at the end it's revealed he's only asleep for about an hour, but over the course of this hour has this vivid dream of the life of Athanasius Pernath 33 years before. And Athanasius Pernath's life takes place in the Jewish ghetto of Prague in probably, I don't think a year is given, but you would think it would be about the 1880s.
It's called Hanpaskas?
Yeah, something like that. Hanpaskasse, something like I'm probably mangling
the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he lives on this street in the Jewish ghetto of Old Prague and is kind of surrounded by these bizarre characters and has in the time that the main action of the novel takes place in the Jewish ghetto in the 1880s-ish, this character, Pernath, he's been released from an insane asylum. He has no real memory of his life. He's a gem engraver, but he's very, he just doesn't really understand what's going on most of the time. You know, people kind of talk around him like he's not there. And there are a couple of threads that he experiences, a kind of a couple plot threads that come in that we can kind of talk about how much they intersect or how related they are or in what ways they're related. But one of the main threads at the beginning is the idea of the golem, right? Which is roughly understood to kind of be this figure that awakes in the ghetto every 33 years in a room with no door, and kind of comes about as this externalization of the spiritual torment of like the psychological subconscious torment and frustration of the ghetto, and comes out and just sort of doesn't really seem like a violent figure so much as just kind of this figure that like walks around scaring people and being weird and doing things like walking toward you but getting smaller so he appears to recede, things like that. So this figure of the golem kind of pops up in these strange ways. And then at the same time, and kind of maybe more as a narrative focus, there is a student who is trying to take down this evil junk dealer named Wassertrum. Charusek is the student's name. And I mentioned earlier that the novel's very episodic. It's very digressive. A lot of the time, some of the most interesting parts of it are these, like one character will tell a story or it'll kind of go down a little history of some particular figure. That's often one of the most interesting parts. So there's a digression that happens where the student Charusek talks about the son of the evil junk dealer, Aaron Wassertrum. And Wassertrum's son was a doctor who would tell people they had glaucoma and perform an iridectomy and make a lot of money by performing unnecessary iridectomies. And he has this whole sort of subtle scheme of manipulation that he uses to trick people into getting unnecessary eye surgery so he can make money. And that's held to be characteristic of Wassertrum's general sort of personality, right? And it's not really till the end of the novel that we get any real clear sense of why Wassertrum is bad, other than, I guess, that he's also blackmailing a high society woman who's having an affair with a doctor, a different doctor. This is all, as I'm like going through the synopsis in my head, I'm realizing it's sounding more and more disjointed. Right. And
Wassertrum is not himself the doctor, it's his son, right? Wassery? It's probably Wassertrum and Wassery, probably.
Yeah, so the son is Wassery. And Charusek has already managed to, I believe, convince Wassery to commit suicide through some kind of stratagem, right? Like that's his technique with these people he regards as evil, is to come up with these scenarios that convince them to kill themselves. And so now Charusek is trying to take down Wassertrum. And in the meantime, Wassertrum is also blackmailing a high society woman named Angelina, who comes to Paranath and says, "You have to help me." And I'm not really sure why she would come. Like, I mean, Paranath is, you know, a gem engraver who lives in the ghetto, doesn't make a lot of money, is generally regarded as insane. It's not totally clear why she would come to him for help. And it's not really ever clear what help he gives her, other than just kind of like riding around in a carriage, being infatuated with her.
I thought Angelina like was about to be caught in flagrante delicto and then came into his room.
Yeah.
To escape. So that's how it all starts, right?
Well, but she also says at one point that when she was a little girl, and maybe this to some extent addresses what I said a moment ago, she says at some point that when she was a little girl, she was about to go somewhere, and Paranath said, "Hey, if you ever need any help, come to me." And she thought,
so it's like a million years later.
Right. It's a million years later. And she's like a wealthy person who has high status. And she's thinking, oh, hey, well, you said this one time. And Pernath, of course, has, you know, after he was released from the asylum, has forgotten the majority of his life. And so he's very drawn to this person because it's some sense of who he was before he went mad. So anyway, he gets really obsessed with helping Angelina, but I don't know that he ever really does anything that helps her. And he kind of has this crush on her, but he has this infatuation with her, but then he's also having an infatuation with this woman named Miriam, who's the daughter of a man named Hillel, who's the archivist at the Jewish library, I think, something like that, who is this very kind of holy spiritual figure. And
it seems like a mentor or a guiding kind of persona for him.
Yeah, exactly. And then, there are a couple other kind of digressive anecdotes that are told. One of them is about a third doctor who catches his, in this case, a doctor of law who catches his young wife in flagrante delicto, actually, with a young man, and is so crushed that he kind of becomes this like sort of hobo messiah figure, like starts this group of people called the Regiment, and basically uses his knowledge of the law to help these kind of poor petty criminals thrive in the world. And and there's this sort of weird underground bar that's run by members of the Regiment where, you know, every table has an empty kind of depression in it. And you once a day, the members of the Regiment are fed soup that's just put directly in this table with these spoons that are chained to it. So anyway, toward the end of maybe the second third of the novel, Charusek creates a situation in which Vasutrum is. Charusek creates a situation in which he expects Vasutrum to drink a vial of poison and kind of basically like has Vasutrum in another room and kind of says this monologue to Pernath that he thinks will make Vasutrum drink the poison. And what happens instead is that Vasutrum plants a watch taken from someone who was murdered, which causes Pernath to be arrested for a robbery and murder. And Pernath spends some time in prison before he spends some time in prison and then has this experience that actually reminded me a lot of something that would happen in a Murakami novel, which obviously, of course, that was decades later, but it's like Murakami read this scene and thought, okay, I'm going to use that as the basis for my whole career, right? Where this other person is arrested and comes into Pernath's cell, and Pernath is like, oh, what are you in here for? He's like, oh, I raped and murdered somebody. And he's very kind of calm and blasé about it. And then when he falls asleep, Pernath hears Hillel and Miriam speaking to him through the rapist murderer's stomach.
Right. Because probably the little people crawled inside his body. And
probably
the dog.
So. So he...
Actually, when you... That rings a... That seems like a really good comparison to me, comparing this to Murakami. In that, like, it seemed to me like I couldn't ever get, like, I could kind of, like, you kind of know what's happening, but you don't ever seem to get a strong grip on why things are happening or how thematically relevant they are or if there is anything of thematic value or if any of this means anything.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
whether
and
something
also
is
the...
symbolic or just weird.
Right, right.
Right, right. And the ways in which these, you know, you have this plot that is fundamentally based in something like the real world, but there are all these little moments that, there are these kind of moments that are maybe hallucinations or maybe real spiritual experiences. Like there's one moment early in the novel where Parnath is in a room with a puppeteer and they're all talking about the golem, and the puppeteer kind of subconsciously accidentally sculpts the head of the golem, and then Parnath finds himself, like his consciousness is transported into this little puppet head that's just been created, and he kind of feels himself rolling around in the sculptor's hands. And then the puppet head gets thrown out the window, and you know, he watches the view from the puppet head as it gets thrown out the window and then kind of comes back into his own body. And that's an example of what I mean when I say that you have this fundamentally, I guess, maybe real world is too simple a way to put it, or, you know, an oversimplification. But this plot that is primarily based in a reality we would understand, with these little digressions into, like you said, Chris, things that might be weird or might be symbolic or might be dreams or might be real experiences with the uncanny. And also that kind of the, if things are symbolic, the symbolic gist of them is often very obscure. So, yeah, he has this, he speaks to the rapist murderer, who basically says, well, I couldn't help it, it kind of came over me, and kind of makes it sound as though briefly becoming a rapist murderer is just kind of like part of a series of, part of a series, like a kind of a thing that happens as part of this sort of spiritual development. That part was very, it was unclear to me what that was trying to convey, other than that it causes Parnath to kind of cease to understand that person as evil, right? And then he's executed, the rapist murderer is executed.
Laponder,
thank you. Yeah, Laponder is executed. And then Parnath,
which seems relevant because later on someone says that Parnath might be Laponder.
Yeah. Yeah,
right,
that
but
too.
Anyway.
So Parnath leaves prison. So Parnath eventually, the evidence is found that is exculpatory to Parnath, and it turns out that Charusek received all of Vasutram's money as an inheritance, and then also himself died shortly thereafter and willed much of his money to Parnath. So Parnath goes back to the Han Pash Gasa to try to find Miriam, and the whole thing has been, for the most part, torn down while he was in prison, right? Like, the whole thing has kind of been gentrified, maybe in modern parlance. And the area has been, almost overnight, has been demolished, and all the residents are missing. And Parnath goes to goes back to his old room. I can't remember. He finds one building from the old Jewish ghetto that's still standing and goes to it. And he's in a room in it, and there's a fire, and he jumps out the window, or he tries to leave through the window. And there's a reference at the beginning of the novel. I feel like this is really important. At the beginning of the novel, the narrator, before he becomes Parnath, thinks about a quote from, I think it's the Buddha, about a crow that sees a stone and thinks it's a lump of fat and tries to pick it up and swallow it and is disappointed when it's a stone and not a lump of fat, and that is many people's relationship to wisdom. And throughout the novel, Paranath has this idea that sticks in his head of a stone like a lump of fat, a stone like a lump of fat. Why is that important? I've got to figure out why that's important. And as he's falling next to this burning building, he sees Miriam and Hillel through a window and tries to grab onto the ledge, but he can't because the stone of the ledge is smooth like a lump of fat. And he thinks, that's it, the stone like a lump of fat. Oh, shit. And then the narrator comes back into his own consciousness and travels to where the old Jewish ghetto was to try to find Paranath. And discovers this house that's sort of like a kind of this beautiful palace. Maybe beautiful palace is exaggerated, but this fine house that's in, it's covered in all these engravings of like Egyptian gods and this, sees Paranath and Miriam smiling and waving at him, only Paranath looks exactly like him. And then their servant says they're sorry that you had the mix-up with the hats, and they hope the hat didn't give you a headache. And that's the end of the novel. So I'm looking, and we're currently 27 minutes into the podcast, and I have just...
Yeah.
Well, I jump in real quick, because I think, because you identified it as important, the quote in the beginning, and I don't think it... My understanding is it's not a quote of Buddha, it's a quote about Buddha, which is actually sort of important, because it's instead of being a quote of Buddha, it's talking, because this is the quote exactly. A crow flew to a stone which looked like a lump of fat, thinking perhaps it had found something good to eat. But when the crow found that it was not good to eat, it flew off. Like the crow that went to the stone, so do we the tempters, which is very interesting, leave Gautama, the ascetic, because we have lost our pleasure in him. And Gautama is Buddha, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
So in that way, if it is about Buddha and not Buddha speaking, it is that problem, kind of spiritual path problem of modeling your life on after the life of somebody holy, and then figuring out too late that that doesn't work, right? Is that, am I, that like, that's not enough, or like that's the you went and tried to live an ascetic life and figured out that the ascetic life was not the path to spirituality for you. It just was for Gautama, Buddha. I don't know if that's, maybe I'm making too much of it, but just like sort of like thinking about the, well, the reason I'm curious about that is because really, like, the thing that I find very befuddling about this book is that end. I mean, the whole book is befuddling, but the, Patrick, you mentioned that Paranath, the narrator is investigating Hanpasgasa, and asking about after Paranath. And people are talking as though Paranath himself is a bit of a myth, you know, like like they don't know if he even ever existed. Maybe he was the rapist. Maybe he was Cherusik, and maybe he's alive. Maybe he died. Maybe he still lives, or maybe he never existed at all. And I don't know how the two necessarily connect. I just kind of latched onto that quote because you brought it up, Hans. But I don't know exactly what to make of where we end, where Mayring brings us. Is there any do you have a strong feeling about, like,
I don't have a strong feeling. I have some maybes.
Sure.
Let's think about the maybes, yeah.
The biggest maybe I came up with when I was listening to this was that there's something to do with mind-body dualism. I think the Cartesian sense. I don't think that Mehrink is like investigating dualism as a philosophical theory, but I do think like he kind of assumes dualism is true. So there was this one particular line, and I'll read it. I have it highlighted in my Kindle app. That really started me thinking about this dualism idea. And then at the end of the novel, when like maybe he's Lepondor, maybe Pernath is Lepondor, maybe he's Cherusic, maybe and like the whole idea of like living another person's life through a dream. But anyway, there basically the quote is this: how much method there was in Cherusic's madness? Was he mad at all? I was ashamed that I had entertained that idea even for a moment. Did not the hints he dropped tell me enough? He was a person like Hillel, like Miriam, like myself. A person over whom his own soul had taken control, guiding him upwards through the wild gorges and gulfs of this life to the snow-capped peaks of an untrodden land beyond. So this idea, he was a person over whom his own soul had taken control, could definitely be, to me, seems to be this place where it's clear that this mind-body this Cartesian mind-body dualism is assumed. And so that made me wonder, you know, is there, let's say that the novel does assume that mind-body dualism is true, or soul-body dualism, is there anything more to that when, you know, say, like, you know, Hillel and Miriam speak through Lepondor when most of the novel takes place as a person dreaming the life of somebody else. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
I think so. Would the...
And I think the golem actually kind of... is related to it as well, because the golem is right. Is like a soulless body, right?
Right, right.
I don't know. Cartesian, does that speak to, because Miriam brings up the hermaphrodite, and I'm kind of latching on to this because of, in part because of my own ignorance, but like, does that have anything to do with the, which seems to be the image at the end of Miriam and Pernath becoming one? Am I understanding that ending correctly, where like Miriam makes a, I think it's Miriam makes a big deal about like the kind of a kind of spiritual goal of life to become one with somebody else? And I think that basically the image at the end, yeah, so like he sees them through a gate, Miriam and Pernath embracing, then the gates close and all I can see is the shimmering hermaphrodite, and then he gets that enigmatic message from the butler. I don't know, does that have anything to do with that? I don't know enough about the Cartesian.
I feel like there's some relation. Like, to me, the hermaphrodite idea struck me as very similar to the ideal of the Platonic forms, the Platonic ideal forms, because I believe in Plato's ontology, you know, the perfect human was an amalgamation of a man and a woman, like they were literally one in one body, just like the hermaphrodite in this novel, and like had characteristics of both sexes, and then later on they got split for whatever crazy Greek reason he gave. So I definitely think there's, I don't know how much like Descartes and Plato are related that much. I feel like they, you know, Descartes being descended from the same tradition, there's probably some overlap, though I'm not quite sure what it is.
Is the, so in mind-body dualism, is the soul hermaphroditic? Is the, or in the sense that it is sexless, perfect somehow?
Yeah, sexless and perfect makes, I mean, maybe sexless, I don't know, but perfect, definitely.
So then the image of the hermaphrodite comes up a couple times in the novel, right? At the very beginning,
right.
One of the first scenes, maybe the first scene with Pernath, is there's a figure that comes into Pernath's shop, or, you know, his room where he works out of, who I think it suggested the figure might be the golem. And the figure gives him a book, and Pernath reads the book and has this kind of cavalcade of visions, one of which is of the hermaphrodite. And then at the end, at the very end, the narrator sees Pernath and Miriam together, and then the gates close, and the narrator sees a shimmering hermaphrodite. So is there a sense in which, it's interesting that the golem gives Pernath this work, which inspires this vision that he then, at the very end, kind of lives out. So the connection there, right, between the golem and the hermaphrodite, if the golem is a figure of body without soul and the hermaphrodite is a figure of kind of like pure soul transcending body, the relationship between those two is puzzling to me. It seems symbolically important, but I can't quite pin
down. Right. It's symbolically important, but I don't know what it's like getting at.
The symbolically important, but that's not, and this may be kind of silly for me to think, but like the desire to kind of have a symbol sort of coalesce into some kind of answer, or more a complete understanding of what, you know, it is you're seeking to learn about, is kind of itself the lump of fat stone problem, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, if you're reaching for
you fuck, I thought we were on to something. You fuck.
No. I think I see where you're going with this. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah.
On.
If you're
so the
no, it's I'm not. No, but Hans, you're gonna take it and run with it.
So okay, so you and I didn't really dwell on this, but you and I thought about the lump of fat stone quote a little bit differently, right? Like my reading of the lump of fat stone, the quote about the lump of fat and the stone is that, for people who are not dedicated seekers of wisdom, things like Buddhist practice can initially seem exciting and cool, right? But then when you actually try to approach them, you discover that they are difficult and rigorous and not fun for the most part, right? And so most people will then say, ah, fuck this. And that's the crow rejecting the stone, right? And so your thought about the stone and the lump of fat is that to some extent the, if I'm understanding where you're trying to go with this, that to some extent, like, the fact that these symbols don't coalesce in an easy, convenient way is part of the point, right? The fact that the relationship is tangled and makes kind of a subconscious sense, if any, and it takes great contemplation, that's part of what the quote is suggesting to us to be aware of.
I think it's actually made more overt in Eastern, let's say Buddhist philosophy than, you know, if you were to say, so I think it is made pretty overt, if I'm understanding it correctly, in Buddhist philosophy, that simply following the teachings of the Buddha or living an ascetic life is not enough. It's not actually there's a problem, a kind of infinite recursion problem with seeking enlightenment, where people may or may not find enlightenment, and then they live as sort of holy men, and they try to teach us how to get to enlightenment, but inevitably, because it's like the goalpost moves, because their path to enlightenment cannot be replicated. I'm pretty sure that's overt in Buddhism, at least some forms of Buddhism. I could not support that. But it is understood as an aspect of the challenge of becoming enlightened or seeking spiritual enlightenment. And so that's how I read the stone and the lump of fat, which is that the lump of fat, you're seeking a kind of an answer, and you get to it and you realize that it's not the answer that you needed. And that's just basically a constant battle in a spiritual search. So then I guess that, you know, my kind of glib thought, as you hear my dog barking, sorry, is that that kind of maybe mapped internally onto the symbols, or the kind of things that could be read as symbols in this book as well. That we would like them to be, we would like them to kind of make some sort of meaning and give us an answer, but then they don't.
So that we see a process by which Parinath achieves enlightenment, and it is confirmed at the end of the novel that Parinath has in fact achieved enlightenment, although, you know, it's unclear if he's still alive or exists as a vision, but like somehow he has become enlightened. But the process by which he has become enlightened is so esoteric and distinct and unique to him that it is not something that we can really emulate or replicate, and it's not something, maybe more importantly, that the narrator can emulate or replicate.
Yeah,
the narrator, who is not Parinath, even though their faces are identical. That makes sense to me as a reading of that. The questions about, I wonder if there's some thematic weight to the question of, so there's Parinath, there's the narrator, and there's the golem. And those three kind of all have the same face, right? I don't know why am I thinking that Parinath and the golem are sometimes thought to have the same face? Is it just because people mistake Parinath for the golem? There's a sequence where Parinath crawls through a city. He like kind of somehow ends up, I can't remember why, but I think he's fleeing something, or he's there for some reason or another that I think might be connected to Charasek and Vasutram. He ends up sort of crawling through this sort of darkened underworld below the city and emerges somehow without knowing how into the room with no door and finds some old clothes and puts them on and walks out in the old clothes and is mistaken for the golem. But the question there is he mistaken for the golem or is he the golem in that moment, right?
They accuse somebody else of being the golem too, right? A homeless person? Or was
they
that...
They do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess the part of the question maybe is like, does the golem, within the world of the novel, has the golem ever existed in the way that it's understood? Or is the golem always this kind of... Are all the golem sightings similar to the ones that... Basically, by bumbling into the room with no door and coming out in old clothes and walking around scaring people, is Pernath imitating the golem or is he becoming the golem? Or is there a distinction there?
I don't know. Oh, man.
I don't know.
What was that, Patrick?
You didn't hear me?
You see, you're quiet or something.
I just said I don't know. I'm not sure. Can you guys hear me?
That's what I. Yeah, I heard you.
Oh, all right. All right.
The golem. I'm trying to think of some of the information that we like some of the things we hear about the golem. It's surmised that the golem, that like there's some kind of like energy that builds up over the course of the 30 years between the times when the golem comes out. And it just is like this kind of flowering of a bunch of sort of like sublimated emotions or things that are sort of charged up over the period of the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I you know, it just to kind of, this is a weird, it's a weird connection, but what you were saying reminded me of 2666, when all of the effort is being made by police to locate the murderer, when what is occurring is actually something that basically everyone is sort of a part of, a kind of like the deaths of the women in 2666 are a systemic like flowering of a lot of other things that are going on.
Yeah.
You know, that everyone is sort of responsible for, and then like, I don't know if that seems pretty off the wall, but you're talking about the golem as being something like that, or
so if maybe like the myth of the golem is a way by which the ghetto understands its own frustration, and you know, something, things happen which are construed as being the golem because that's how the ghetto tells itself the story of its own psychology. And Pernath accidentally participates in that. But maybe
like
there's some kind of...
Like a ritual, almost.
Right, like a ritual that happens accidentally and subconsciously. Which would make sense, I guess, because the golem is understood to be a manifestation of the subconscious of the ghetto. I think that's said relatively explicitly in the text, as I recall. So the fact that Pernath subconsciously finds the room where the golem's outfit is and emerges as the golem, it's appropriate that that would happen subconsciously without him realizing it, because the golem is, in fact, a manifestation of the collective subconscious of the people who live in that place. Which also makes it interesting, too, that there's another, we're saying 30 years, sometimes we're saying 30 years, sometimes we're saying 33. I think it's 33. I think it, I mean, which it, I believe was Jesus' age when he died. I don't know if that's relevant. It, I'd imagine it has to be somewhat. But the gap of time, like the period when the narrator puts on Pernath's hat, that's another golem cycle later, right? That's another 33 years. So is the narrator becoming the golem, or is it significant that the narrator, if the narrator has Pernath's face, is the narrator now going to enact the golem ritual? Or is it significant that the narrator sees Pernath in the state of enlightenment, and does that somehow break the golem ritual or bypass its need?
Or did the gentrification of Han Paskasa change that cycle too, right? Because
right.
It's not the same place. So the golem, the cycle must change to reflect that. Hans, what do you like about this novel?
That's hilarious.
Well, I, you know what I like more than anything? This is maybe a good, one thing that I did the research on this. Well, research is maybe too strong a word, but you're giving me an opening to talk about something that I happen to do, which is that I told you guys to read the Mike Mitchell translation, right?
Right.
And I, myself, purchased and attempted to read the earlier translation from 1928 by Madge Pemberton.
For
this podcast, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. After okay. I told you guys to read the Mitchell, I thought, well, I'll buy the Pemberton and I'll read
you,
that, right?
You and, dirty fuck. You cheating liar.
And I did end up rereading the Mitchell because the Pemberton didn't appeal to me at all, right? Like, I got about a third of the way through the Pemberton and I thought, geez, like, Chris and Patrick are going to ask why I picked this book. I remembered it being great and I'm not digging this at all. Like, it's just sort of there, right? And I thought, well, maybe I'll go back to the Mitchell. And I had never actually, I had never personally read multiple translations of the same book. I don't know if you guys have ever done that. I think you guys at least seem to have done it to some extent with the Odyssey. So I got the, once I had decided that I wasn't really enjoying the Pemberton translation, I thought, well, just for grins, I'll read a few passages side by side, right? And I'm saying this partly because it does tie into what I enjoy about the novel, right? So this is very early in the novel, right? But this, I'm going to start by reading the Mitchell translation. Let me see if I can find the, so there's, we didn't mention her at all in our synopsis, but there's a character named Rosina who's sort of like a, She's 14 and she's sort of like this teasing kind of figure that's kind of disgusting but kind of sexy and sort of drives a couple characters mad in this, who are both kind of these peripheral characters. But there's a description here of Rosina. Her teasing smile, and this is from the Mitchell translation, right? I'm going to start with the later Mitchell translation that I had you guys read. Her teasing smile and waxy rocking horse face disgust me. I feel she must have white, bloated flesh like the axolotl I saw just now in the tank of salamanders in the pet shop. I find the eyelashes of people with red hair as repulsive as those of rabbits. That's nuts! It's nuts, right?
It is completely bonkers. As soon as it is completely bonkers. That's why I asked. No, Hans, I'm glad you're going down this path because this is exactly why I asked why you like this novel because I think it is on the sentence level, for me too. But go on. Sorry.
So I mean, anyway, and I'll we'll come back to that, right? But I want to read you the Pemberton translation here, right? So let me see if I can find the equivalent sentence in the Pemberton. Okay, so it's the first section. It's called Day. I picked this because it's right at the beginning of a chapter, so it's easy to... Okay, so here's the Pemberton. Let's see. I did not meet her look. I detested that insistent smile of hers and her waxy rocking horse face. Her flesh must be white, surely, like that of the axolotl that I saw the other day at the bird shop in the salamander's cage. As for the eyelashes of the red-haired, I'd as soon as contemplate those of a young rabbit. That doesn't have any of the zip, right? Like, what the fuck does that even mean? And I don't know how much... I don't know how much of that tone is created by Mitchell in the translation, right? And
is
that
Mitchell,
tone.
Madge Pemberton sounds English. Is Mitchell an American English speaker?
I believe so. I don't know for sure. I think he might actually be. So the publisher for his translations is Daedalus, which is a UK publisher. So I think he might be English as well. I think it might be a time thing, right? Like the Pemberton translation was from 1928.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
But I think, I mean, when I think about this novel, right, I think about this novel that is bonkers in this really entertaining way at a sentence level and full of all these weird atmospheric little scenes and set pieces and all these funny, like, kind of meandering anecdotes, and that has, like I mentioned earlier, this sort of emotional timber that switches between this kind of, like, high-intensity cynical meanness, this, like, weird intellectualized off-the-wall meanness, And a little bit of this other kind of genuine warmth and passion, right? And I find it incredibly entertaining at a sentence level and totally inscrutable at a macro scale. And I guess, like, one thing that I've learned about myself as a reader is, like, all the books that I'm the fondest of are books that have that profile, right? Where they're very enjoyable at a sentence level. And then when you come away from them, you really have to chew over what the hell you just read, even though you know that it was on a micro scale, very entertaining. And that, you know, the passage about her disgusting eyelashes looking like a rabbit, like, it's all like that, right? That's not out of character.
Right.
So that's why I liked it.
Interesting.
Well, I don't know that we cracked this one, guys. I don't know that it is crackable.
As is the ritual too. One of us has to lose a finger. We didn't do it.
I picked the book and we can't figure it out. So I'll have to go cut my pinky off with a cleaver.
Yeah. Right. Make sure you YouTube it.
I just bought just a few days ago the novel that Mayrink wrote after this came in the mail, and I'm going to be interested in seeing if it is. You know, because, like, there's not a whole lot of critical stuff available about the Golem, and most of what I did read, the kind of biographical and critical stuff, suggested that the Golem is known for being fractured and fragmented and kind of spastic, partly because it was a first novel that was written over a long period of time by a person who was in great spiritual crisis. So I'll be interested in seeing how that style developed for the second novel, which is called The Green Face. But anyway, my hope is that it'll have that same kind of zing, sentence level zing, but maybe kind of a more coherent set of plot and ideas. But if it's just a lot like the Golem, that'll be fine too. Although I don't know if, like, I mean, with Murakami, right, there's like, when I read Murakami, there's a very intense, and maybe other people didn't have this experience, but for me, there's a very intense sense of diminishing returns once you figure out what his thing is, right? Like, if you're going to start reading Murakami, make sure that you pick a really good Murakami novel, because the first one you read is probably going to be the one you enjoy the most, whatever the first one is. And I don't know if maybe Mayrink's, his kind of set of writerly tics, if there's a diminishing return that you get moving through multiple iterations of that. But we'll see, I guess.
I wonder... That question is interesting to me. Is there a writer where there aren't diminishing returns? Like, it seems like all the best writers kind of have a shtick, right?
Yeah, I guess the writers that... So this is like such an... You can probably guess what my answer is going to be for like not diminishing returns here, right? But like... When I went through DeLillo, DeLillo has a shtick, right? Like, DeLillo has a very clear DeLillo thing. And I did not find there to be diminishing returns, at least in his, like, run of best work, right? And I think my thought at the time was, like, he's got a thing that he does, but he also, through his run of really good stuff, was consistently... Like, each of those novels are, they're set in different time periods, they're structurally different, they're tonally different, they're thematically different. Thinking here about, like, you know, The Names versus White Noise versus Mao Tu, you know, like, The Names and White Noise are both very clearly DeLillo novels, and, you know, you can read one sentence and you know who you're reading, but, like, the, you know, The Names is, like, almost like the Golem, where who the fuck knows what any of it's supposed to mean, and White Noise is like over determined as to like how completely thematically obvious it is, right? And the making those, like, I think the trick for somebody who's able to work well with a large catalog is to have some amount of things that signal them as being themselves consistently, while also taking on projects that adapt that self into very different directions, which I would not say is something Murakami has done.
Right. Yeah, I think that's reasonable. That actually reminds me a lot of, like, that comparison makes me think of a couple different McCarthy novels where, like, obviously from his prose you can tell who he is, you know, who the writer is, but, like, comparing, like, his weird ironic novel Sutri to the rest of his catalog is, you know, it's different, it's like way out there. So I guess I wouldn't say there's diminishing returns there either. Interesting.
The other one that comes to mind is and we've never really read this author or talked about him at all, but, like, and I mean, again, there's some fall off at the end here, but, like, peak Martin Amis, I think, has that same quality where, like, his prose is always very much his prose. But, like, if you think about, like, Time's Arrow versus London Fields, right? And I know you guys aren't familiar with either of those books, but again, like, his prime work is very good at finding totally different ideas, tones, themes, so that I think, you know, if it works really well, what happens is that, like, discovering the breadth of how, like, discovering the, if you can discover kind of the breadth of how somebody can use their style over several books, then that makes, that kind of increases the richness of approaching the style in a single book. Right. But that's very, very rare that somebody can do that. And, you know, both DeLillo and Amis also, only about a third of their whole body of work is really like prime stuff. Right. Again, as opposed to Murakami, who it's like it's all about as good as everything else. Right. Like, none of it for the most part is drastically better or worse, but it's kind of all like it's like all bites of the same cheesecake, you know. I don't know. Maybe all the Murakami fans in the audience are listening and seething. I don't mean to.
You know what I'm going to say?
What's
R.L. Stine.
Oh, you love
R.L. Stine.
You love R.L. Stine.
Yeah, dude.
Goosebumps all the way, baby.
Never gets old. Goosebumps all the way.
Well, you know.
You figure out his stick about four books in.
The original Stine is dead, though.
Is he? It's just some sort of like,
it's like a property now. Like Tom Clancy is a property now. It's like written by.
How do we get that? Guys, we need to get that job. I mean, I will just write R.L. Stine books for, you know, money.
Well, first you have to independently publish something that is a bestseller or something.
They don't court unproven writers.
Right.
They're not just swooping in and getting graduate students right out of MFA programs.
I don't think so.
You remember that story about the mask that doesn't let go of that kid's face? Did you ever want to write the sequel?
Yeah. I actually don't know why they don't do that, because like they could get some real slave labor that way. Like, of course they should be recruiting these, you know, quote unquote unproven writers, you know, who just want to write and get something published and be like, you know, yeah, we'll pay you a pittance for this work.
Yeah. This like 0.0001 cents a word. You know, like just
less than what a literary journal pays you.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, no, but Patrick, maybe more if you write more. Because you're guaranteed publication.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah. That's true.
No, it's monstrous. It's truly monstrous.
Yeah, it is truly monstrous.
I should just briefly note that R.L. Stine is not, in fact, dead.
Oh, he's not?
Okay.
He or she?
He.
It's a dude. Yeah.
It's a dude.
It's a living dude.
But Tom Clancy is definitely dead, and, like, that is real. Like, Tom Clancy's, you know, Death Point Midnight, written by, you know, John Smith, John Doe Smith. Right, it's ridiculous shit. And it's
I read one of those. Yeah, I read one of those.
You did?
Years ago. I used to work for the local parks department technically in Lacey, which is not quite Olympia, but I used to work for City of Lacey Parks Department. I was a parks technician for the summer,
mm-hmm.
and somebody left one of those like Tom Clancy presents. Zero Death Hour by Fred Smith, right? Like somebody left one of those in a park.
I love it.
Somebody left one of those in a park, and I just kind of kept it in the truck. And like when somebody else was driving us park to park, I would read it just because I was bored. And it was quite bad. It was quite embarrassing.
Oh yeah. We should have a contest to see who can come up with the best Tom Clancy novel name. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, this the Golem. That was, you know, I'm not like, there were definitely points when I was reading it and I was like, man, this is super neat. And I think for me, it was definitely in like the digressions, like you said, Hans, especially like Cherusik's like weird scheme, like the, where he talks about how he drove the eye doctor do suicide. I was like, this is fucking great. And then the rest of the novel happened. And I was like, what happened? Where, like what happened?
You know,
it's just, I wasn't clear on how everything kind of fit together, and I'm still not, which is why you're cutting off your pinky. But you know,
or like Babinski, we haven't even talked about the Babinski digression.
Oh yeah, there was the Babinski I actually highlighted that. That was kind of neat. But
I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, anyway. I did too.
Probably don't have time to go into it now, but right. I was enormously looking forward to discussing this novel with you guys, and I really appreciate your taking the time to try to crack it with me.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that at least I didn't input more. I really don't know. I feel like, Chris, you had some good ideas, though.
Yeah, I think that the reason that I asked why Hans liked it, because I don't think of Hans as really liking puzzle books, like where like it's sort of like, what does this mean?
Really?
And so it's interesting that we talked about that so much. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Hans, correct me if I'm wrong. I just don't think of you that. I think of, you know, I think that kind of figuring out what things mean is not always. I just don't attribute that with your taste. But
well, I like it as long as I know there's not actually an answer, right?
Yeah.
If you think about something like Zeroville, like there's not an answer to Zeroville, right? There's not a thing you can figure out that like unlocks it. And I love Zeroville, right? And Zeroville is definitely, although it's, you know, up until the last 10 pages, Zeroville is infinitely more coherent and linear than the Golem. I appreciate the enigmatic quality of it. I guess I like things that, I really like things that I don't come away from them feeling like I've got everything that's in them, you know? If I can, you know, like, To Kill a Mockingbird is great, but like you read To Kill a Mockingbird and you're like, okay, I think I understood everything that book was trying to tell me. You know, if I come back to it, it might be like revisiting an old friend, but there's not... I got all the meat out of the crab, you know. I don't have to keep digging in the shell. So that's certainly something that I appreciate about the Golem.
I actually think I feel the same way about a novel. Like if I come away from a novel like feeling like there's something to be gotten in there, but I don't know exactly what it is, I like that a lot. I just think my threshold for it is like a little different than yours. Like,
I feel
like things that I would come away with thinking, that's a puzzle. You would come away with, yeah, I got all the meat out of that. Like, I definitely got everything that has. Just because I tend to think that, like, you're...
I'm just more arrogant.
No. I was actually going to compliment you about how sharp your intellect is, but whatever. Oh, you ruined it.
Sorry.
Anyway, as my voice fucking cracked.
So we're all dying to know what the next pick is.
Are we?
Yeah. 25 hours long.
Okay. So I want to read, I've already started it, East of Eden by John Steinbeck.
Oh, cool.
Have either of you read Steinbeck? Anything by Steinbeck?
Of Mice and Men, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah, that's good. But I'm a pretty big Steinbeck fan, but I'm only very narrowly into his catalog so far. I've read The Grapes of Wrath, To a God Unknown, and Of Mice and Men, all of which I really liked. And I knew at some point I wanted to do a Steinbeck novel, and I thought, you know, like, maybe it's time to do what... Like, there's an argument between whether The Grapes of Wrath or East of Eden is his like magnum opus. So I don't know which one it is, but I've already read The Grapes of Wrath, so I thought East of Eden would be cool. It's one of those multi-generational stories, which I tend to hate, which is why I put it off. But I don't know. I'm riveted so far. I've gotten about a quarter of the way through it, and I'm just absolutely riveted. So hopefully you guys like it too.
Excellent.
If not, there's nothing I can do about it.
Very good. Well, I'll look forward to it.
All right. Well, cool. Thank you, listeners, for checking out our podcast on Gustav Meyrink's The Golem. Hopefully you got something out of it. Maybe... maybe there's some piece of the puzzle that we talked about that, you know, you can use to solve the book in your mind. So until next time, listeners, peace out.